ancient institution. It's a relatively recent one, and it's built on, again, the religious industrial complex as a way of controlling people. So, you know, this is not such a great thing in and of itself if you understand its real history. That's enough for me, but I'd like, in the last few seconds that we have, to just let people know that my guest has been, of course, Yasmin Nairn. She's a co-founder of the group Against Equality. She wrote the piece, The Secret History of Gay Marriage, and she has also, her works appeared everywhere, anthologies, journals, and it's been in Captive Genders, Trans Embodiment in the Prison Industrial Complex, Singleism, What It Is, Why It Matters, all kinds of places. And if you're not familiar with her work, I really urge listeners to find out more. Well, your final thoughts just in the last couple of seconds that we do have here.
I think that this is about, you know, for me, it is a moment of happiness and of great depression. I'm happy that the gay marriage movement is finally over so that we can move on. But I'm also duly depressed. And I think I want to read listeners to be cautious about what is going to happen next. We have lost so much psychic and financial energy, really, that it's and we have so many issues left. And I'm really concerned about how we're going to start working on them without the resources. And we have a long, hard road ahead of us. However, I'm also deeply optimistic because I think there's a lot of resistance as well to the gay mainstream agenda. And I just want to give a shout out to many of my friends who on Sunday, yesterday, launched a fantastic protest against the mainstream gay pride.
We're flat out of time. And we can talk more, put more on on the website. Thank you so much for your time today. My guest, of course, has been Yasmin Nair. This has been Air Cascadia for Monday, June 29th, 2015. And Joe Clement engineered the show for us today. Thanks for that. Joe Kathleen Stevenson is the KBO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts, know your rights, take a stand.
host for this good conversation about our place on the planet. And this week, we were supposed to be having Richard Martin on as a guest, who wrote a book called Cold Wars. He seems to have disappeared. So we're going to be running a show we ran a couple weeks ago about Toms River, New Jersey. Before we start the show, I just wanted to make a couple comments about the amazing events of the past week. Last Monday's Supreme Court decision upholding the Affordable Care Act and Friday's court decision legalizing same-sex marriage. I'm thrilled by those decisions. Still, they remind us of how much work remains to be done to secure human, civil, and economic rights for everyone. But it's great to have some things to celebrate as we look forward to the struggles ahead. I also want to note that possessing, smoking, and growing marijuana becomes legal in Oregon in 2 days. The sea change was most apparent in the article the Oregonian ran the other day on tips for growing pot. Now we're going to listen to a show a couple of weeks ago about the Toms River and the incredible chemical pollution that came from the dye plants there, starting in the 1950s.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host, for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Chemicals are an integral part of modern life, but sometimes we forget how dangerous they can be. The story of Toms River, New Jersey is a poignant reminder of the risks of mixing chemicals and capitalism. A story journalist Dan Fagan unravels in his Pulitzer Prize-winning Toms River, a story of science and salvation. This morning, Dan joins us to tell the story of a town ravaged by sicknesses tied to chemical pollution. Dan, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks. Glad to be with you.
Well, one of the things that really stood out for me, it was a kind of a surprise in a way, was learning that all of the, or many of the pharmaceutical companies that we're so familiar with today actually had their beginnings making very toxic dyes and polluting the communities that they were in. And this is in a sharp contrast to the image we have of pharmaceuticals companies today, which have a very sanitized kind of image. So I wanted to start by talking about the origins of these pharmaceutical companies and the impact that they had on communities like Toms River.
Yeah, that's right. It was somewhat of a surprise to me, too. I knew, of course, that these companies were old and that they had originated predominantly in Europe, with the exception of DuPont and a couple of others. But what I didn't know is how intimately they were linked to coal tar and to dyes made from coal tar. Coal tar was really the first industrial waste. And people were looking for something to do with that waste, just as they try to figure out things to do, chemical products to make from today's hazardous waste associated with petroleum refining and others. So they were doing that, and accidentally, a young man, you could call him, I guess, the Mark Zuckerberg of his day, discovered accidentally that they make really good dyes. A particular derivative of coal tar called aniline. You put it through some other chemical processes, and you get a really gorgeous purple dye. And he immediately thought, gee, this could be a very profitable product, and it was, as were a whole series of dyes produced from other highly toxic products. But almost immediately, those same products started causing really severe health problems, both in factories where they were made and also in the surrounding neighborhoods. And one of the things I discovered, to my surprise, was that those difficulties were very well documented as early as the mid-1860s. You could see the poisoning take place, and I explain all that in the book.
Well, let's talk about the difficulty it is in trying to prove the correlation between what seem like obvious toxins and the actual impact that they're having on human health, or actually on any health, whether it's human or animal or plant health.
Yeah, that's true. You know, there are some kinds of poisonings that we can see the impacts immediately. These kinds of these kinds of very immediate effects. But when we're talking about chronic diseases like cancer, for example, there's a very long latency period between the exposure or exposures, there's usually more than one, and the appearance of the disease. 5-10 years can pass. And in addition, the symptoms of those chronic diseases are the same kinds of symptoms that can be caused by other problems, too. So it's really difficult to look back in time and reconstruct what kind of environmental exposure led to what kind of specific health problem. The only exceptions are when you have a situation, as with asbestos, which causes a very specific kind of cancer, that mesothelioma, that is caused by almost nothing else. Well, then, you know, that's, if you're looking for the compensation you deserve, I suppose that's the kind of cancer that you want, because there is a fingerprint that you can trace back to a specific exposure, which is why on television and on the radio you're constantly hearing ads from lawyers' offices saying, do you have mesothelioma? Call us. But for the rest of us who have, who may be suffering from chronic illnesses that have much more generalized symptoms, it's very tough to look back and figure out, pin a particular environmental cause on that health problem. And the story of Toms River is a story of how scientists try to do that. And it's quite fascinating and intricate, but also can be easily understood if you take the time to learn it, process that scientists go through, the process of environmental epidemiology. It's a little bit like solving a mystery, like CSI cancer. That's what this book is about. It's really about everything that this town went through, the heroic people involved, and also the not-so-heroic people. And the process that was used to sort of solve this epic mystery.
Well, before we get to Toms River, I want to go back to Basel, Switzerland, and maybe even before that. And I want to talk about what were the impacts that started to be discovered when Basel was one of the principal capitals of dye making. Is that correct? After the discovery,
it was.
And that things changed environmentally in Basel. And I'm curious about what kinds of illnesses cropped up, and if there were any parallels prior to the dye poisoning that was happening that could be used by doctors and scientists to kind of track how you figure out the correlation between these new illnesses and the industrial practices.
Yeah, well, it was difficult now. It's difficult then. It was even more difficult then because, of course, this was brand new. But I do explain in the book that, you know, there's one particular plant that was located right in town. In fact, I visited Basel and tried to find the specific location of this plant. It continues to be used by the chemical industry, but of course it's now all white-collar big office towers. So it's hard to flash back to more than 150 years ago and imagine what conditions were like then, when Basel was very much of a manufacturing center with all these brand-new dye plants everywhere, and a huge amount of dumping into water sources. But that's what happened, and I explained that you know, there was a house nearby where the servant made tea with water that was from the local water well, and that tea and coffee was heavily poisoned. And I explained the process whereby the chief health inspector of Basel tried to solve that mystery. And interestingly, the city authorities in Basel moved much faster than we would see from today's, you know, modern health departments or EPA. They ultimately shut down that plant in a matter of a couple years, which, of course, we would never see now with our current, you know, highly bureaucratized process of environmental enforcement.
Now, that plant was owned by a company that became SIBA, is that correct?
Yes, it was. So, there's a whole sort of complicated process by which these companies were found and then merged and then to some extent spun apart. And I explain that in the book, that's quite fascinating too. And pollution problems were really key to so many of these maneuvers. Basically, the whole idea with making dyes is that you generate much more waste than you do actual product. That was true in Basel in the 1860s, and it was true in Toms River in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Just a tremendous amount of waste, especially liquid waste, was the byproduct of this dye manufacturing. And I should say, too, that it started with dye manufacturing, but it certainly didn't end there. All of these companies expanded into plastics, petroleum distillates, and ultimately pharmaceuticals, among many other products.
And, I'm not sure if pharmaceuticals have quite the same level of ratio of waste to product. But certainly,
no, they don't.
But certainly the petroleum products are another example of incredible amounts of mm-hmm. toxic byproducts.
Yeah, that's true. They use toxic products, and the products they produce are toxic, and the byproducts are often toxic. But it's hard to generalize about these things. You have to sort of look at them one by one. And it's true that the pharmaceutical businesses in general produces less waste, but it is certainly not a zero-waste business, not by a long shot.
Now, what was happening to the workers in these plants? Because you're saying that the process of making these dyes was highly toxic. So besides the waste going into the waterways and polluting the communities and people drinking poison, what was going on with these people who had like daily, maybe 8, 10, 12-hour-a-day exposure to the products?
Right. Well, the factory workers, as always, are the most highly exposed and the most at risk. And that's where the links to chronic disease really first started to pop up strongly. People noticed in Switzerland and in Germany, where these early aniline dye plants were located, that many workers who spent their days just literally coated in dyes, you could see what color they were making that day by what color the clothes of the workers and also the color of the water, the nearby rivers, were dyed. Then you'd know what color they were manufacturing at the plant. Well, these workers were extremely highly exposed, and a physician by the name of Ludwig Wren in Germany, as early as the 1880s, noticed that a tremendous number of them were getting bladder cancer. And it would take another 60 or 70 years before the chemical industry would acknowledge that some of those dye products were causing hugely high numbers of bladder cancer. The plant that ultimately wound up in Toms River had moved from Cincinnati, Ohio, the Sebigaigi plant, and in Cincinnati, the exposures were extremely high, and so were the bladder cancer rates. In some cases, more than two-thirds of the men, and they were men, who were highly exposed, working in one particular production line, came down with bladder cancer, and that's really an astounding number. It's just not something that you would see in almost any other context.
Well, Sebigaigi moved from, they were basically booted out of Basel, it sounds like, and then they wound up in Ohio. What happened in Cincinnati that encouraged them to move to Toms River?
Right. Well, it's true that wherever they went, ultimately pollution issues and to a lesser extent worker illness, problems with worker illnesses, clusters of disease among workers, made the company highly unpopular. In a sense, Siba never moved from Basel. Basel remained its world headquarters and is the headquarters of the successor company now. But their manufacturing did indeed move all over the world, first to Cincinnati, first to some other places, and then Cincinnati, and then Toms River. The reason they left Cincinnati was twofold, really three reasons. The first is that the tremendous number of workers were getting sick, and that was a budding controversy, and they wanted a place where they could start fresh. Secondly, there was horrible pollution of the Ohio River, and there were a series of congressional hearings that were really quite embarrassing for several of the companies, including the company that was a Swiss-owned company called Cincinnati Chemical. And the third reason is that were making a lot of money from these dyes and plastics, and they wanted a lot of space. They wanted a place where they could ratchet up their manufacturing, where they could do it with a lot of privacy. They wanted there to be an easy water source, both to use the water for manufacturing and to dump the water. And they wanted sandy soil, because if you dump liquid waste on sandy soil, it disappears. It doesn't really disappear. It goes into groundwater, into drinking water source aquifers, pumped up, then could be easily pumped up and distributed by water wells. And that's what happened in Toms River. But it took a while for everyone to discover that. So in the short run, finding a big open place with sandy soil and lots of water, where there was also lots of privacy, was ideal for these manufacturers. And that's why they moved to Toms River in the mid-1950s.
So if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Dan Fagan, who's a journalist and author of the prize-winning book that came out a few years ago, Toms River, A Story of Science and Salvation, that's now out in paperback. So what was it particularly about Toms River that was so appealing? Let's describe like where it's located and the kind of the geography and the topography of the setting.
Right.
And maybe also the demographics of the community.
Right. Well, as I said, it was geographically relatively isolated, and there was good transportation access to the clothes manufacturing sites, a lot of the places that would use these dyes. But more importantly, it was a community that really desperately needed the economic development. There was almost nothing happening in Ocean County, New Jersey at that time. Toms River was somewhat of a backwater, and the state was very eager for any kind of economic development in central and southern New Jersey. So they were very eager to have the plant come, and they welcomed the plant with open arms. There were dirigibles flying overhead and brass bands, and only a few people raised questions, specifically local fishermen, raised questions and said, gee, is this really a good idea? Are these products safe? And the company assured everyone that the conditions would be safe. They even said that they would stock a pond full of fish and that those fish would swim in the effluent from the factory. They quickly abandoned that promise when it was clear that the fish could not survive in the effluent. But by then, the factory was already built. The county began growing very rapidly, largely because of this plant, which became one of the largest employers in the whole area in between New York City and Philadelphia. So everything was going great if you didn't think too hard about the long-term risks associated with so much pollution.
Well, actually, just for listeners to get another sense, actually, this is really close to the Jersey Shore, the famed Jersey Shore, and an area that actually is one of the few parts of New Jersey not noted for its pollution, I think, back in the 50s.
Yeah, that's right. Of course, that early, northern New Jersey was highly industrialized, but southern and central, including the shore, was not at all industrialized. Now that situation, or that situation somewhat changed, in part because of this plant in the 60s and 70s. But certainly it's a part of the state that people really cared about their environment. They cared about it then. They certainly cared about it now. And ultimately that was the undoing of the plant, which is now shut down. But it was a kind of an epic struggle conducted by local environmentalists and outside groups like Greenpeace. It was it's quite an amazing saga of how things ultimately changed and how the plant went from being a bulwark of the community to being a pariah. And part of that, of course, is the emergence of the cancer cluster. But it's also because the plant pumped a lot of its liquid waste into the ocean, and that really offended people. There were lots of things that were done at this chemical plant that ultimately proved to be quite shocking to people once the word got out.
So what were the first signs that there was something wrong with this plant that they had welcomed with open arms?
Yeah. Well, the first signs, and this happens a lot, actually, were on the plant itself, on the plant grounds itself. And that is that the plant, the discharges of wastewater began to foul the plant's own water wells. So the drinking water that the workers would drink, it tasted funny, and people quickly stopped drinking the water. The company's solution to that was to relocate its water wells up gradient so they wouldn't be contaminated by the company's waste, which it was dumping into the ground. But that didn't help the rest of the town at all, because the areas where the company was dumping led directly into the Toms River, which is really just a little trickle of a stream. And so this was a tremendous amount of pollution to add to a very small stream. And then right down the creek were the town's main water sources for the public drinking water. So there were a couple of water wells pumping furiously right beside the river. They would draw that contaminated river through the sandy riverbanks and then distribute it all over town. And so the same people who tasted the water that tasted a little funny to them when they worked at the plant, now were getting that same tasting water at home, too. So as early as the late 50s and early 60s, it was clear that the town had a significant pollution problem, though the company and the local water company did its best to try to keep that quiet.
So when people's water is tasting funny, what is their response?
Well, people were confused. They were suspicious. But it was also a sort of an earlier time, a kind of a naive time about environmental pollution. And to some extent, people were in denial. The company was employing several thousand people. It paid very good wages. These were blue-collar jobs that nonetheless paid well enough that you could buy a house and start a family, and then your property continued to appreciate as long as the town kept growing. And for a while in the 60s and 70s, Ocean County was one of the very fastest growing counties in the United States. It was a real boom, and the chemical plant was a significant part of that. So some people were concerned, but few of them were concerned enough to really act aggressively. The town, especially because the chemical company and the water company got together and secretly agreed to build this pipeline that would transport some of the most severe waste out into the ocean, would send it about 10 miles across Toms River, and then across Barnegat Bay, across the Barrier Island, and then dump it in the ocean. And the idea was, well, nobody would notice it out there. Some people in the beach communities were still very concerned, but it did effectively postpone the environmental reckoning and allowed the company to continue to operate another couple of decades without really having to confront its environmentalist critics.
Well, there was a big scandal and outbreak in the late 60s that you write about. And so what caused that and what caused it to subside?
Yeah, well, there were a whole series of problems. In the 60s, Toms River itself began to smell very badly. People's water also tasted funny. So the company's solution was to build that 10-mile pipeline that essentially just moved the problem to the ocean, but the ocean's a big place. We used to say the solution to pollution is dilution, and for a while that worked. Then in the 70s, the company was caught doing some illegal activity at its landfill, dumping things that it shouldn't have dumped. And so there were attempts to get some enforcement done there, but they didn't really lead to any fundamental changes in the plant's practices. And then in the 1980s, there was, the growth, sort of the general growth of environmental consciousness in America had an impact in Toms River. And local activism began to grow against the chemical plant. And ultimately, the ocean pipeline was shut down, and that led to the closure of the chemical plant. But again, it didn't really penetrate the psyche of most of the town. That started to happen only thanks to the activism of several local people led by a woman named Linda Gillick, who began to notice that lots of children in town were getting cancer, and they wanted to know why. And they weren't exactly certain why, but they were certainly suspicious about the chemical plant. And ultimately they learned that it wasn't just the chemical plant that they should be concerned about, that there was also another site in town where some really atrocious illegal waste dumping had occurred that was caught and identified and cleaned up very sloppily, allowing much more contamination to continue for years afterwards. So there were a couple of big toxic sites in town that would both ultimately be added to the so-called Superfund list. But it took a while for all that to happen. And then even after those sites were identified as hazardous waste sites, how do we know that they were, in fact, the cause of the excess cancer rates among children in Toms River? In fact, how do we even know that there really were unusually high children's cancer rates in Toms River? Well, answering those two questions is really the heart of the story in Toms River. And ultimately, Linda Gillick and the other local activists in town proved to be right. At least they were more right than wrong. There really were extremely high childhood cancer rates in Toms River. And ultimately, those exceedances were associated with some specific pollution problems in town, namely air pollution from the chemical plant and contaminated water from the other hazardous waste site in town. But figuring that out was really a very intricate saga of political activism and personal heroism, as well as some really nifty science.
You mentioned the air pollution, so let's talk a little bit about those all that midnight burning that was going on at the SIBO plant, as well as the dumping into the groundwater, or dumping into the soil, which went to the groundwater, and dumping directly into waterways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. One of the problems that the chemical plant had was that, you know, when you're making dyes and plastics, you're burning really unusual kinds of, you're combusting really unusual kinds of products. And they made very visible kinds of air pollution, really unusual colors. And everyone could see it from miles around, and they could smell it. Sometimes they would see the dust, the pellets from the pollution downwind on their plants, on their cars, on the windows of their homes. So they were upset about this, and there was some community activism seeking to change it. And the company's response was to identify the so-called visual pollution and say, okay, well, people are concerned about how this looks. No problem. We'll take care of this by burning at night, by doing our most visible burning at night when people can't see it. And so that's what they did. You know, instead of dealing with it in a more fundamental way, coming up with safer processes or eliminating the most highly polluting processes, they just said, no problem, we'll treat this as visual pollution and we'll burn at night. And that's what they did. And to some extent it worked. Again, it postponed the reckoning for a while longer.
Well, if they were burning stuff that was creating residue on people's windows and in their cars and on their plants, wouldn't that residue still be there whether or not they burned during the day or during the night?
Yes, and it was. And people continued to notice it. But in general, it was just a little less visible because the connection to the plant was less obvious. Because during the day, when they would look over to the plant smokestacks, they wouldn't see those very colorful emissions. So they weren't as quick to put the two together.
Well, let's talk a bit more about Linda Gillick. What got her involved in dealing with trying to make a correlation between the cancer clusters that she was perceiving and her belief that it was related to what was in the water?
Right. Well, her son Michael Gillick, her second child, Michael was diagnosed with neuroblastoma when he was just a few months old. And at that time, neuroblastoma was a truly devastating illness. It was likely, in fact, that he had neuroblastoma while he was still in utero, while he was still in the womb. And so that was a really devastating thing for Linda and her family. And the doctors told the Gillicks that Michael had only a 50-50 chance of making it to his first birthday. And you can only imagine how incredibly traumatic that was. The Gillicks did the very best they could for Michael, but it was a horrible childhood, filled with lots of operations and incredibly excruciating medical treatments. They would take Michael up to Philadelphia, over to Philadelphia, or up to New York very regularly because Toms River was too small a place at that time to have a pediatric oncology ward. And every time that Linda would take Michael to one of these hospital wards in New York or Philly, it seemed like she met other families from Toms River, and this really puzzled her and alarmed her. Why are there so many kids from Toms River and a relatively small place at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia or New York Hospital or wherever she was with Michael while Michael was getting these treatments? And Linda's personality was very outgoing. It still is. She's got an activist personality. She's a former school teacher. She was very much of a communitarian, somebody who wants to know what's going on, and she was not the kind of person to sort of suffer things in silence. So she started asking a lot of questions, and she discovered other families that had these problems, and she wondered why. She formed a support group involving many of these families, and ultimately she tried to get the state health department interested in doing some kind of an environmental study to see whether something was happening in Toms River. And the state health department showed no interest in doing that and kept telling her no. And so that's where things stood until the mid-1990s, when a nurse by the name then of Lisa Bornazian, who worked at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia in the pediatric oncology ward, she too noticed that there were a lot of local cases. And she was very concerned about it. She said something to the doctors, and the doctors said, oh, just do your job. It's a coincidence. Keep your head down. Well, she didn't want to do that. You know, she had bonded with many of these patients. She had gone to funerals in Toms River. She had spent hours and hours with the parents during these horrible treatments. And when she would go to Toms River for these funerals, several of which she attended, she would drive past the chemical plant and say, oh, well, that's the plant that I remember people talking about. So Lisa, as it turned out, has a sister-in-law who works for the Environmental Protection Agency. And Lisa and Laura were talking about it at dinner one day, and Laura said, okay, I'll look into it. And Laura knew who to call, another agency called the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, a very obscure federal agency that nonetheless does investigations of environmental health problems. And the ATSDR finally got the state of New Jersey Health Department to take a serious look at whether, in fact, there was more childhood cancer in Toms River than expected. And sure enough, the health department found there was way more childhood cancer than expected in Toms River. In fact, every category of cancer that the health department looked at showed much higher rates than would normally be expected given the population size and the characteristics of that population. So that was alarming. And the folks at the state health department talked about it among themselves and said, what should we do about this? And ultimately, they decided to do nothing. They decided to keep this quiet, that it would be too difficult and too expensive to do an investigation, but that if they talked about these findings, it would just alarm people. So they decided not to say anything at all. And, you know, Barbara, that's the worst possible thing you can do in this kind of situation, because then when the word does get out, as it did in this case, people are convinced, in this case accurately, that you're trying to hold back information, that there's a conspiracy. And essentially, that's what happened. Word got out. There was a big, huge article in the Newark Star-Ledger, the largest newspaper in New Jersey. And then there was huge panic set in Toms River. All kinds of wild things happened that ultimately led to a comprehensive investigation, the kind of investigation that Linda Gillick had wanted for a very long time.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning about the amazing chemical pollution caused in the town of Toms River, New Jersey, by the chemical plant Ciba-Geigy. And my guest is Dan Fagan, who wrote a book about this called Toms River, A Story of Science and Salvation. So in the remaining part of the show, let's talk about what was the upshot once the word leaked that there was, in fact, a strong correlation between the or that there was a huge amount, an excessively huge amount of cancer cases among children in Toms River, and the possible link between that and the chemical plant.
Right. Well, that was the first breakthrough, the finding that there that there was, in fact, a significant childhood cancer cluster in Toms River. But that's, as difficult as it is to figure that out, that's still easier than trying to figure out what the cause is. So it took another 5 or 6 years for the state and the Centers for Disease Control to do a joint investigation. And to everyone's shock, they ultimately concluded that for leukemia, and specifically for young girls, that there was indeed a statistically significant relationship between exposure to contaminated water and contaminated air and rates of childhood leukemia, especially in girls. And that was really a shocking finding, because these cluster investigations almost never find a statistically significant correlation, because when you're talking about cancer in a residential area, it really takes a really huge cluster in order to clear this statistical boundary, the statistical test that we call significance. It's really difficult. It's a little bit like conducting an opinion poll and only asking 12 people for, you know, who they think is going to be the next president, and therefore saying, okay, we've polled 12 people and we know who the next president's going to be. There's just so much uncertainty associated with that. And this is the problem with studies of cancer in the community. Cancer seems like it's everywhere, but actually cancer is not one disease. It's more than 200 individual diseases that have characteristics in common. So if we break that up, we see that cancer is actually pretty rare, and so there are relatively few cases to work with, and that raises uncertainty. But in Toms River, the problem was so severe that it could be identified and strongly correlated with environmental exposure. And that's really a big reason why I wrote this book, Barbara, to show that Toms River is no fluke. The only fluky thing about Toms River is that we found it, that ultimately, because the problem was so severe and because the people like Linda Gillick were so incredibly insistent and because some really good science was done there that isn't often done, we were able to identify this relationship. But everything that I know from being an environmental journalist for the last 30 years, going all over the world, tells me that there's nothing unique about Toms River except the fact that we found out. So I wrote this book really to let people know that it's not true that we can never demonstrate the relationship between pollution in the environment and illness in our community. It can be done. It's difficult to do, but it can be done. And that we need to act on that information. We need to be much smarter about looking for these correlations, and we need to be much smarter about reducing environmental exposures. And I'm especially concerned about what's happening overseas in China specifically, which is now by far the overwhelmingly dominant player in the chemical industry, where the Toms River process is repeating itself with tragic consequences. And I'm very pleased that a Chinese language version of Toms River has just been published, because I very much want the word to spread in China specifically, where environmental exposures are so high.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. We were just listening to an archived episode of Locus Focus. We had a problem getting hold of our guest for today. You were listening to Barbara Bernstein talk with Dan Fagan about his book, Toms River, A Story of Science and Salvation. Up next, we're going to be turning to the Monday Morning Radio Zine, where we will be speaking with author Aspen Baker about her new book, Pro-Voice, How to Keep Listening When the World Wants a Fight, about the access to the abortion controversy, after these messages.
Attention KBOO members and listeners. The KBOO Foundation is seeking to fill 4 upcoming vacancies on the Board of Directors. Terms run 3 years, beginning on October 1st. The nomination packet, due July 11th, is posted on the KBOO website, and paper copies are available at the station. Candidates must submit the completed nomination packet via email to kboocommunity@gmail.com or mail or drop